Welcome to the Philippe Matthews Show at thepmshow.tv. Named the Oprah of the Internet by Mark Victor Hansen, Philippe Matthews doesn't ask questions that are different. He simply asks questions that make a difference. The Philippe Matthews Show features entertainers, bestsellers, authors, thought leaders, change agents, and world-class experts in the field of personal, spiritual, and professional development. An internet marketing entrepreneur, Philippe is the creator of the How Movement, dedicated to teaching people how to move from the mindset of hope to the process of how. If you are ready to take your life to the next level, move from the mindset of why to the mindset of why not. Tune in right now to this latest edition of the Philippe Matthews Show and watch your life grow.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on another edition of the Philippe Matthews Show. I have with me an incredible guest with incredible research. His name is Richard Rothstein. After Michael Brown was shot and killed by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, the Economic Policy Institute on October 15, 2014, came out with a 40-plus page report authored by Richard entitled The Making of Ferguson, Public Policies at the Root of His Troubles. And for those who don't know, Rothstein has written extensively about how poverty affects education and has spent years studying the evolution of residential segregation nationwide, and he is a research associate of the Economic Policy Institute and senior fellow of the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much.
That was a mouthful because you've done so much. Where did this work begin for you? I know it's your job, but it's a job that I think is backed by some level of passion.
Well, for a long time I've been studying education policy, as you mentioned, and I came to the conclusion, not original with me, that we could never close the achievement gap between black and white students unless they were attending integrated schools, because when you have children with disadvantages that make them less able to take advantage of what schools have to offer, if you have an individual child who's come from a home with parents, for example, who are not very literate and don't read to the child very much, or who come from a home where they've had to move around a lot because they've fallen behind in rent, or because they're in poor health, a teacher can devote attention to that child, special attention to that child, and raise that child's level of achievement. But if you get classrooms where every child, or almost every child, has those kinds of disadvantages, teachers can't devote special attention to those children. And so the whole level of instruction deteriorates. It becomes a remedial classroom, not an on-grade level classroom. Children who come to school in great stress because their parents have suffered economic problems, unemployment, or because there's violence in their neighborhood. Again, a teacher can devote special attention to individual children like that, but when you have a whole classroom of children like that, then you get more disciplinary problems. So you can't really solve the educational problems that we're trying to solve in classrooms where children are so segregated. And then it became obvious to me that we can't desegregate schools unless we desegregate neighborhoods, because schools are segregated because they're located in segregated neighborhoods. And so then I began to investigate how those neighborhoods became segregated, and that's the origin of this work.
Wow, that is enormous. I was blown away. It was one of those things, especially being African-American and growing up with some level of awareness of what's going on, but not having that level of confirmation, which is what you have done. I'm assuming that's why you're going to correct me, that this is not a, your research was not necessarily popular to certain people in terms of what you found and exposed, because it's kind of a black eye, if you will, on, because this is at the federal level for many years, as you began to dissect and uncover Ferguson, but it was also something that was kind of, it was nationwide. It was institutionalized throughout the country in terms of, and we're going to get into some of the particulars, but in terms of segregated schools, is that correct?
Well, yes. The neighborhoods have been segregated. Every metropolitan area in this country has segregation, residential segregation. And this residential segregation, most people think it happened by accident or because of white flight or because of private prejudice or because real estate agents were steering people to one place rather than another. But in fact, the neighborhoods in every metropolitan area in this country were segregated by federal policy, deliberate, purposeful federal policy, and by state and local policy as well. We have a government-sponsored system of racial segregation. And it's not that my research has not made people happy. It's that most people have forgotten this entire thing.
Interesting
point. It used to be well known. Excuse me?
That's an interesting point. So it's just that people kind of have forgotten and are blaming it on just environment or society or poverty. And it's like, no, it goes a lot deeper than that. These were actual laws that were in place.
Well, that's right. We've adopted this myth that we have something called de facto segregation. You know, it just sort of happened, as I say, because of white flight or private prejudice. But in fact, we have segregation by law, by public policy. It was created that way. The policies persisted throughout the 20th century. And simply passing laws, as we now have done, saying you can't discriminate, doesn't undo any of the segregation that existed in the past. And it gets transferred from generation to generation. So I can describe some of these federal policies to you if you like, but this was not an accident.
Yeah, I that's what was kind of shocking to me, to see how far it went, because I think when you're living in it or a product of it, you see it. You can't see the forest for the trees because the tree is in front of you, and that might be the realtor, that might be the house you're trying to buy or that particular situation, not knowing that it goes deeper than that, all the way up to the federal level. Talk to me about, and we're, you know, this is about Ferguson, but this is really about kind of all of these laws that were, you know, throughout the country in various different parts of the country, and particularly every state and every city. How were, in using your language, how were the ghettos designed, if you will?
Sure. Well, the first policy, probably the main policy, well, there are several important ones, but one of the main ones was the National Public Housing Program, which began in the 1930s. Most people think of public housing as something for poor black families. In fact, public housing began in the 1930s as a New Deal program primarily for whites because there was a national housing shortage. In the Depression, builders weren't building houses, and the population was expanding, and people had no place to live. So the federal government began a public housing program, and it built it on a segregated basis, explicitly segregated. It didn't happen by accident. The federal government had a policy that some projects were for blacks and others were for whites. The black projects were placed in inner-city areas. The white projects were more likely to be placed in white areas. And frequently, the federal government demolished neighborhoods that were integrated in order to create segregated ghetto areas. So, for example, you want to talk about St. Louis. St. Louis is an example of that. There was in the 1930s, there was a neighborhood in downtown St. Louis called the DeSoto Carr neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That neighborhood was integrated. It was about half black, half white, because workers, whether black or white, had to be able to live close enough to the factories where they worked to walk to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an integrated neighborhood. The federal government and the city of St. Louis demolished that neighborhood and eventually built a public housing project on that neighborhood, on that area for blacks only, and built another public housing project farther south away from that area for whites only. And this was true throughout the country. It wasn't always the case that that integrated neighborhoods were demolished. Sometimes you had neighborhoods that were already had larger numbers of African Americans in it, but that's where the public housing was placed for blacks and for whites. It was placed in white neighborhoods. That was the first policy.
And this was 1930.
began in the 1930s. It began in the New Deal with the Public Works Administration, and it continued very heavily during World War II,
mm-hmm.
when the federal government vastly expanded its public housing efforts to build housing for workers who flocked to centers of war production. In California, for example, the city of Richmond, take that example, was the largest center of shipbuilding during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It had virtually no African Americans living in the city before the war. By the end of the war, it had nearly 15,000 who had come mm-hmm. to the city, and there was no housing available. White workers flocked to the city as well to work at these shipyards, predominantly white workers. The federal government built segregated public housing in Richmond. So it created segregation where no segregation had existed before because there were very few African Americans living in the town.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened in San Francisco and then throughout the area and in every metropolitan area in the country. So the war housing was a big part of this.
Fascinating. There's a story that you share in the report about Larman Williams in 1968 that I'd like for you to bring all of this kind of home and connect the dots with. Can you share that story? Because he was one of the first African Americans Ferguson, to purchase a home?
No, it wasn't Ferguson. It was a suburb of St. Louis. But
okay.
It was a suburb of St. Louis. But like many African Americans who wanted to move to white suburbs in the that period, he was not able to do so. And frequently, let me step back for a minute. You know, after these ghettos had been created by the public housing program, the federal government decided that it was going to suburbanize the white population, explicitly suburbanize the white population. And as the housing shortage eased, whites were able to move to these whites-only suburbs that the federal government created and leave public housing, leave urban areas, and blacks were prohibited by the federal government. So, for example, in St. Louis, there were a number of suburbs that were created by builders who went to the Federal Housing Administration. They got banks to issue loans that were guaranteed by the federal government on condition. This was a federal government condition that no homes be sold to African Americans. In the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, Daly City is perhaps the best known example.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember Pete Seeger used to sing a song about houses on the hillside made of ticky-tacky.
Mm-hmm,
Westlake
mm-hmm.
in Daly City. That was a development built by a builder named Henry Dolger, who got guaranteed building loans from the banks with federal guarantees on condition that he not sold homes to African Americans. So all of these suburbs were created in the 1940s and 50s when whites were able to move to suburbs that were being created that once the housing shortage eased, and blacks were prohibited from doing so. So you had what some people have referred to as a white noose created
mm-hmm.
around central cities that were inhabited increasingly only by blacks. Now, the fellow that you talked about, an African-American school teacher who wanted to move to a decent suburb, was unable to find housing in many places, any places really in the suburban St. Louis. He was about to move back to his home in, I think it was Kansas, as I recall, and he finally was able to get a home in a white community because somebody fronted for him. A white purchaser bought the house for him, and without letting the seller know that he was an African American, and that's typically the way very few African Americans who were able to move to the suburbs did so.
Now, what's interesting is when you keep saying this is at the federal level, I think I want to bring this home, and that is What were the consequences if you sold to an African-American family? What happened to you if you, because you were breaking federal law?
Well, it wasn't, you weren't breaking federal law, but you were breaking the contract under which you bought the home. This was a regulation, a procedure of the Federal Housing Administration. So the Federal Housing Administration frequently required, strongly recommended, that any builder who got a Federal Housing Administration loan to construct a suburb put in the deed of the home a provision prohibiting the owner from reselling the home or renting the home to an African American. If the seller did do that, did sell a home to an African American, neighbors could sue the seller and force the sale to be revoked and the African American to be evicted. And the courts throughout the country enforced these provisions. They were called restrictive covenants. And the courts enforced them. In 1948, the Supreme Court said that those covenants were unenforceable. But it didn't say they were illegal. They just said you couldn't go to court to enforce them. And so for the next 8 years or so, instead of going to court to evict African Americans, these covenants instead permitted homeowners to sue the seller for damages. So that they couldn't evict the African American, but the damages were so prohibitive that nobody dared sell to an African American. That was finally also declared unconstitutional, but still, even after those provisions were declared unconstitutional, the Federal Housing Administration continued to ensure developments that were openly excluding African Americans.
Now, which I found fascinating, you were saying in the mid '60s, Ferguson was what's known as a sundown town, which I had never even heard of, where African Americans were banned after dark.
Yes, yes, that's true. There was a there's an adjoining town near Ferguson called Kinloch, which was the area in which African Americans lived. Many of them were servants, domestic servants in the town of Ferguson. All but one of the streets between Ferguson and Kinloch were blocked off to prevent residents from of Kinloch from coming into Ferguson except in this one route which they could use to come to their jobs as domestic servants. And they were not permitted to come into the town after sundown.
Unbelievable. Now, also, the report shows that when they created these segregated neighborhoods for African Americans, that they allowed, prostitution, taverns, all kinds of seedy, industrialized businesses that were not allowed in the white communities. Is that right?
Well, what you're referring to is zoning. Beginning in the 1920s, the Supreme Court permitted cities to create zoning ordinances which prohibited certain kinds of construction in some areas and prohibit other kinds in other areas. Typically, and this still exists today, you had the first residential zones, which were single-family homes, second residential zones, which had multiple-family homes, apartments, two-family homes, and then you had commercial zones and you had industrial zones.
Mm-hmm.
If a neighborhood typically consisted of single-family homes of white homeowners with restrictive covenants, for example, that would prohibit resale to African Americans, zoning commissions in many cities, and specifically you're referring to St. Louis, zoning commissions would designate those neighborhoods as first residential zones in which nothing but single-family homes could be built. If the neighborhood had African Americans in it, the zoning commissions would frequently, and in St. Louis did, classify those neighborhoods as neighborhoods where industry could locate, where commercial businesses could locate, taverns could locate, and in fact in St. Louis they even encouraged the houses of prostitution to locate in neighborhoods where African Americans lived to keep them out of other places.
Unbelievable, wow.
So this was the zoning, and it still exists today.
You say in the report the federal highway system routed highways through urban areas often to eliminate black neighborhoods that were close to downtowns. Can you go deeper in that? That's amazing.
Well, this is another federal policy. The federal highway, interstate highway system that was began in the 1940s and 50s and then was formalized in the National Housing Act, Highway Act of 1956, had two purposes. One was to bring white suburban homeowners into downtown areas for their jobs, but the second purpose was to remove African-American neighborhoods from areas close to downtown and push the ghetto farther away so that it did not come close to downtown business areas. And this was the open purpose in many cities. In other places, the highways were used to create barriers between black and white neighborhoods to make it more difficult for black families to relocate across the highway to white areas or even for people to walk or drive there. I don't know if you've ever been to Chicago, but
I'm from Chicago.
Okay, well, the Dan Ryan Expressway. That was designed to separate the black and white neighborhoods. And it created a barrier that tried to contain black neighborhoods to the east to protect the white neighborhoods from the west from any African Americans. So this was a systematic throughout the country is one of the purposes of the interstate highway system.
Absolutely.
And let me just emphasize, I want to emphasize to you, this was open. This was not a hidden purpose. This was not sort of an accident, an unintended consequence of highway building. This was an explicit open purpose of the highway system, and it was spoken about openly by highway planners.
Absolutely fascinating. So, you know, another factor in this that I'm reading in the report was basically just inadequate municipal services in black neighborhoods. You know, just basic things. You know, sewage, street lights, garbage pickup. Speak to us about those things that also occurred as a result of this segregation.
Well, once you had a situation where African Americans had very little housing available to them outside these ghetto areas where they were concentrated both by public housing and because the population was growing and other neighborhoods were closed to them by restrictive covenants or even by, as I said, the Federal Housing Administration policy, African-American neighborhoods became overcrowded.
Mm-hmm.
They had to pay, African-Americans had to pay much more to rent an apartment than whites had to pay for similar apartments elsewhere simply because of the laws of supply and demand. There were so few apartments available to African Americans relative to their demand compared to whites who rented apartments in other areas. So the neighborhoods became overcrowded because in order to make these rent payments, families had to subdivide their homes. They had to double up with relatives. And so you had a very, very overcrowded neighborhoods developing that otherwise would not have developed had the supply of housing available to African-Americans been comparable to what was available to whites.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once you had an overcrowded neighborhood like that, you demand much, much more city services in order to simply maintain its quality. You need garbage collected much more frequently if the density of the neighborhood is greater, and usually in cities, for example, they did not collect the garbage more frequently. Well, this kind of thing started to build up. The street lights weren't maintained as adequately in black neighborhoods as in white ones, and the black neighborhoods became slums. The white families living in suburbs looked at these neighborhoods and concluded that slums were a characteristic of African Americans, not a result of the public policy that overcrowded them and then denied services to them. So when African Americans tried to move to suburbs, in addition to being prohibited by the federal policies I mentioned, white families became afraid that they would bring the slum conditions with them. And so you got the white flight, a fear develop, which was rational in the sense that the African-Americans were coming from slum neighborhoods, but the white families didn't realize that this was a function primarily of public policy, not of the characteristics of the families themselves.
And so in that, there is a lack of quality schools because they're now segregated. And so it's kind of like a vicious cycle and circle, a hamster on the wheel. You have no property value, so you can't build the wealth. You show some great margins in there on the wealth disparity, the disparity between whites and blacks, that they could not build wealth and equity in their home as white neighborhoods and white families were able to do.
Well, that's correct. I mentioned before subdivisions like Levittown in New York or Westlake and Daly City south of San Francisco, or the suburbs like that in the St. Louis area. In the late 1940s, early 1950s, white families were able to buy homes in subdivisions like that for around $7,000 or $8,000. That's about $125,000 more or less in today's money. Those homes today sell for $500,000, $600,000, $700,000. The white families who were who bought into places like Levittown and Westlake and Daly City and the suburbs of Ferguson gained that equity at a time when black families were unable, prohibited from doing the same, even though they had the same economic circumstances, the same kinds of jobs. These were working class families, same kinds of jobs, same kinds of skills, but were prohibited from doing so. Well, this gain that came through the next two or three generations of perhaps $500,000 in equity, white families who moved into these suburbs were able to use that gain in equity to send their children to college. They used it for their retirements, so the children, their children didn't have to support them in retirement. Black families who were forced to remain in ghettos gained none of that equity. Well, today, nationwide, average African-American incomes are about 60%. That's 60% of white family incomes. But black average family wealth is about 5% of white family wealth. And that difference between the 60% ratio for income and the 5% ratio for wealth is almost entirely attributable to federal housing policy, racially explicit housing policy.
So where does that leave us? What are some of your, at the end of the report, you give some solutions. Whether or not they're realistic and how we'll be able to be activated or not is another story. But what can we undo the damage that has been done?
Well, we can, but the first thing that needs to be done is that we have to reacquaint Americans with this history. Because as long as people sincerely believe that we have de facto segregation, segregation that just happened by accident because black people don't have enough income to move to the suburbs or because of private prejudice.
Now, I think it's also the ripple effect, too, Richard, is that, you know, one law has a ripple effect on the entire society and a population of people in general that I don't see. As you say, it goes so deep, people really just don't know. Even some blacks, we don't know. You know, we haven't got a clue. Yeah.
Right. And so I think that the first step, if I can say so, is we have to re-educate the American people about how this happened. Because if the American people come to understand that these ghettos, that the segregation that we have today was created by government policy, that, of course, is unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
It was created in violation of the Constitution, in violation of the 5th and the 14th and the 13th Amendments to the Constitution. De facto segregation is just an accident. But the jury segregation, the segregation that we have, was created in violation of the Constitution. And if people become acquainted with this history, then they may be open to considering what remedies may be required. Because if you have a constitutional violation, you're required to remedy it. But until we have that understanding, as I say, this history has all been forgotten. It was once much better known than it is today. This history has all been forgotten. Until we reacquaint ourselves with that history, I don't think there's going to be much openness to considering how it can be remedied.
Now, it's interesting you said this, that there was a point when this history was known, but nothing was done. It continued and obviously was allowed to be part of the practice and a standard of America. What's different between then and the consciousness, I guess, of America now? Looking at what happened in Ferguson and Baltimore and so on, and many different cities around the country.
Well, I don't want to be Pollyannish about this. It may be that even if people become reacquainted with the history, that nothing again will be done.
Mm-hmm.
But I am saying that the first step has to be to, as you're doing, broadcast this history, make people aware of it, so that we can begin to consider what our constitutional obligation is to undo it. There's no guarantee that if people understand it, that we will fulfill our obligations. But if we don't understand it, it's guaranteed that we won't fulfill those obligations.
A young family starting out, hearing this, what are some of the first steps they need to take? And actually, not just a young family starting out, but even perhaps a seasoned family hearing this for the first time. What would some of the first steps logically that they would take?
Well, I don't think this can be, I'm not sure I understand your question, but I don't think this can be solved at an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
We need public programs to remedy the constitutional violations. For example, I gave you the examples a few minutes ago about Levittown and Westlake and other suburbs like that. A remedy is going to require subsidies to permit African Americans, because no good. We passed a law in 1968 saying it's no longer permissible to discriminate in housing. It wasn't permissible before, but we made it explicit in the 1968 Fair Housing Law. So we said, okay, African Americans, you now have the right to buy into Levittown or to buy into Westlake or to buy into the suburbs of St. Louis or any of the other cities in the country. But it's a meaningless right for the most part, because those homes are now unaffordable to working and middle-class African Americans, whereas they were affordable when the discrimination, the public policy discrimination was going on. That can't be remedied without some form of subsidy to African Americans that permits them to buy into middle-class suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the welfare recipients. I'm talking about middle-class and working-class African Americans,
mm-hmm.
of whom there are millions, but who can't afford to buy into the middle-class communities that they would have been living in had the federal policy not prohibited them from doing so. But those subsidies are not going to be forthcoming unless we understand it's a constitutional obligation to remedy past public policy. And we're not going to understand that, as I say, unless we become familiar with the kinds of historic public policies that you and I have been discussing.
Mm-hmm. So looking at Ferguson, looking at Baltimore, those communities that we see on television, those communities that I grew up in Chicago, south side of Chicago, are a direct result of segregation and these policies and the lack of quality education, the lack of transportation to those
better schools and what have you, creates an entire generation and sub-generation that never gets a chance to, if you will, get a piece of the American dream.
Well, that's correct. As I think you said it before, it becomes a circle, a circular process. Living in segregated neighborhoods does not give children the opportunity to succeed in school. And if they don't have an opportunity to succeed in school, they're more likely to live in segregated neighborhoods as adults.
You were on a show, I think, and you were talking about something, I don't know if it was in the report or not, about George Romney.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney's father, who was working on the Nixon administration, I believe, at the time. Can you tell us that history, that story, and how that connects to segregation? Because you said it wasn't necessarily legal, but it was unconstitutional.
Right. Right. I think what you're referring to is, I said earlier that this history was once much better known than it is today. It wasn't commonplace knowledge, but it was much, much better known. In 1968, Richard Nixon was elected President of the United States, and he appointed as his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development George Romney, who had been the governor of Michigan. And he was a moderate Republican. He wasn't a radical. He wasn't a liberal. He wasn't a Northern Democrat. He was a moderate Republican. And even he recognized the history that I've been describing. He used the term that I used before. He said the federal government has created a white noose around black neighborhoods in urban cities, in urban areas. And it's the responsibility of the federal government to untie that noose.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Romney began a program he called Open Communities. And under this program, he required suburbs, white suburbs, to do the following things. They had to repeal any ordinances they had that prohibited the construction of apartments, of multifamily dwellings, two-family dwellings or garden apartments. Many of these suburbs that were all white had ordinances, zoning ordinances, that permitted only single-family homes. So he said that they have to repeal those ordinances. Secondly, he had said they had to accept their fair share of public housing. Again, I'm not talking about high rises, but scattered public housing units.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to also permit developers to build subsidized moderate income apartments that would serve to integrate these communities. And he said if they didn't do that, he was going to withhold all federal funds from these suburbs for things like sewers and water projects and green space, all the things that communities get money from the federal government for doing. And he actually withheld federal funds from three suburbs. One of them was Baltimore County for being segregated and for refusing to take action to desegregate. Well, there was an uproar. President Nixon reined him in, said that he didn't believe in forced integration, and Romney was eventually eased out of his position as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and the Open Communities program was canceled. And we've had nothing that aggressive since. But again, it was possible even to talk about it at that time because people were familiar with how the federal government had created this white noose, and we're not likely to be able to talk about these things again until people again become familiar with it.
So are you saying also it's just not the conversation that people like you and I are having and the research that you've done, but it's also the politicians. So it's about lobbying and trying to make change here.
Well, yes, it's the politicians, but the politicians are not going to respond unless the people start talking about it. And that's why I think the kind of education that you're doing in this program is important, and it's important that it go much beyond that to familiarize the American people with how we got where we are today, something that's now been forgotten.
Did I leave anything out in terms of questions that you wanted to bring out on this on our conversation, or parting words or thoughts with this report? I assume you're doing other work as well.
Well, this is, yeah, I'm working on this topic. The report that you're referring to was about Ferguson because St. Louis was in the news, and I applied these themes to the city of St. Louis and showed how they apply, but they took place in every city in the country. One of the things I did recently, or within the last couple of years, was I looked at textbooks that are being used in to teach American history.
Mm-hmm.
In high schools around the country. And what I found was that textbooks that are being used in high schools around the country misstate this history. They don't tell the truth about it. They misstate it. The most popular American history textbook in the country has one paragraph in the entire 1,200-page textbook devoted to discrimination in the North. And it has one sentence devoted to residential segregation, and the sentence reads as follows. It says, "In the North, African Americans found themselves in segregated neighborhoods."
Wow.
That's it. They found themselves. They woke up one day and said, look, here we are in a segregated neighborhood, with absolutely no mention of all of the federal programs that had required them to live there. So one of the things that your listeners can do is go to their local high schools and school districts and see whether they're misteaching this history. Of course,
mm-hmm.
they have to become familiar with the history first to be able to ensure that it's being taught properly, but that's something that anybody can do, because if we don't start teaching this history properly, the next generation is not going to be in any better position to correct it than the present generation is.
Correct. Yeah, I think it was just it went viral. The lady from Texas saw
yes.
A textbook that referred to slavery as immigration.
Workers. They called slaves workers.
Workers.
Yeah.
Which would suggest a wage, and it just unbelievable in terms of I guess you would call it the whitewashing and sanitation. Of this issue.
But the passage I mentioned a minute ago is not just in a Texas textbook. It's in every textbook in the country.
Wow.
It needs to be corrected.
You have written several books. I did not mention all of those books as well for our listeners. You are a well authored. What was your latest book?
Well, my latest book was written almost 7 years ago, so I don't print about it very often, but it was called Grading Education, G-R-A-D-I-N-G, and the previous one was called Class and Schools. Both of them are about education policy and talk about the racial gaps in academic achievement.
And where can people get in contact with you and find your books? And obviously, they'll be able to go to our site once we have this up to be able to do that. And we'll promote it rigorously. But
address? They can go to the Economic Policy Institute website, which is www.epi.org. And there's a list of so-called experts. A menu of experts on that site, and if they scroll down to my name, they can find copies of all of the articles I've written on this topic and also my address to get hold of me, and I welcome correspondence from any of your listeners.
Fantastic. Richard, thank you for taking the time out and having this conversation with me. I actually would love to have you back on the show and perhaps even on our live video show, which airs around the world. I think this would be a fantastic topic to expose at that level.
Thank you very much. I'd be glad to.
Fantastic, Richard. Thank you for being with me. We'll talk soon.
Okay.